Thank you, Jerry, and good morning, everybody. I'm Shivani Ghosh. I'm from Tufts University, and I'm going to put a nutrition lens to this. I'm a nutritionist. I'm a human nutritionist. I have worked in agriculture, so hopefully I'm able to speak a little bit about the linkages of agriculture and nutrition. I'm part of the Nutrition Innovation Lab, which is at Tufts, and we have three major research questions that we've been tasked to look at. One is, what are the measurable impacts of investing in agriculture? Is there a positive or negative effect on nutrition itself? And the nutrition outcomes are what Rob Bertram has outlined, particularly for USAID, is stunting, which is shortness of age in children under 5 years. We also are very interested. We are a policy school at Tufts University, and we're very interested in understanding how policies, multi-sectoral policies, will affect the quality of nutrition services provided, for example, or how agricultural interventions would be implemented through policy levers. And lastly, we also look at biological mechanisms, trying to understand how factors such as aflatoxins or diseases through foodborne illnesses or conditions such as malaria, infectious diseases, could affect nutrition and therefore have an effect on what would normally be an improved effect of agriculture on nutrition. So for the purpose of this presentation, I'm going to try to focus primarily on the third point, where we're going to look at two different studies that are going on with the Innovation Lab. One is looking at aflatoxins, and the other one is looking at an analysis of presence of cattle and malaria in households. Just to give you an idea, the Nutrition Innovation Lab is really focused on conducting large-scale studies. We, from an economics angle, these are panel studies where we actually follow the same households over periods of time. Sometimes it's on an annual basis, sometimes it's every 3 months. We also do longitudinal studies with a lot of focus on epidemiology and nutrition epidemiology. Now, in terms of the GFSS and the GFSA, as well as the Feed the Future initiative in its second part, it's really focused on trying to contribute towards the sustainable development goals. And Rob has outlined that very eloquently in his presentation, particularly sustainable development goal 2. And for those of you who are not familiar, this is essentially, these are the sustainable development goals, which have followed on the Millennium Development Goals as of 2015. The second one is zero hunger. From a nutrition angle, I feel that a lot of these, all of these 17, have an effect on nutrition. They might be mostly indirect, but at a population level, this is, all of these are pretty important, but some of them are more direct. This is, of course, something that Nora has shown in her presentation on the global food security strategy for USAID. And the focus of our work at the Innovation Lab is really on Objective 3, but also linking Objective 2 and 1 to 3. But we are coming from the angle of being the ag economists and the nutrition epidemiologists trying to understand at a population level how these interventions and activities could affect nutrition outcomes. Why is this important? The scale of the problem is huge. Rob has outlined this. 24% of the world's children are actually stunted. That figure works out to be about 161 million. You also have about 50 million children who are considered as wasted, which is they're suffering from acute malnutrition, and they have the highest risk of death. We also have, and this is something that Rob outlined as well, is the whole issue of overweight and obesity. And the reason I want to highlight this is often people who are overweight or obese also are nutrient deficient, particularly in vitamin and mineral deficiencies. So you may think that this looks like a normal healthy person or not a normal healthy person because they are overweight, but they are actually also as likely to have nutrient deficiencies as someone who's undernourished. The key point to make here is stunting is shortness for age, and some might reflect that what does it matter? Some of us are short. Genetically, we may not actually reach our full potential, or we are meant to be. Does that have an effect? What we are finding in the realm of stunting research is it's not just about what your attained height is. It's about your ability to be a productive individual. There's a lot of research that is showing that there is cognitive impairments linked to stunting. There is issues around economic productivity as an individual, as a household, and as a community. So this is just to emphasize two things. One is the scale of the problem is huge, and B, it's important for us to look at this because of the fact that there is a long-term economic productivity issue linked to not addressing nutrition outcomes such as stunting. Now, just sort of moving into the realm of foodborne diseases, because that was one of the mandates for me to look at was food safety. This is a recent graphic from the WHO. And what you find is that the burden of foodborne diseases, and obviously those of you, all of you in the agriculture sector know the importance of foodborne diseases, it's pretty high. We have just under 500,000 deaths that happen because of foodborne diseases, and a third of these are children, and children under 5 years of age. From a nutrition angle, this is really important. We spend a lot of time talking about nutrient-rich and nutrient-dense diets, but we don't look at what are those factors that could prevent the utilization of a nutrient-dense diet. Let me just put this out in a form of a map, which will sort of highlight the issue here. This is the map of stunting. This is the prevalence of stunting. This is from UNICEF, and what you see is that it's Africa and it's South Asia. These are the two regions of the world where you find the highest burden of stunting. If I were to overlay a map of anemia, which is because it could be of nutrient or non-nutrient causes, you will find a very similar pattern. If I were to put any other nutrient deficiency, for example, vitamin A, you will see that sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia are the two parts of the world where you find the highest burden of these nutrient deficiencies. And what's very interesting is this is an estimate of foodborne diseases by globally and by different regions. And I'm sorry, I couldn't get the numbers in there for some reason, but what you're seeing is the maroon and the oranges are where you're seeing the higher rates of deaths because of foodborne diseases. And again, it's a very similar pattern. Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia are the two parts of the world where you see a very high burden of foodborne diseases. So how does this all link up together? And this is a simple conceptual framework to try to explain an extremely and exceedingly complex issue. What you have on the left-hand side are all the disease agents, and this is in particular foodborne diseases, but you could put any infectious disease such as HIV, malaria, or any other conditions on the left-hand side. In this particular case, this is an example of foodborne diseases, and it's sort of trying to identify a sort of a pathway by which you will have these disease conditions affecting nutrition. In the case of foodborne illnesses, it does have an effect on gut health and intestinal. There's intestinal damage associated with repeat episodes and repeat incidents of foodborne diseases. And what's very interesting is people do have repeat episodes and repeat incidents. So it's not like you have diarrhea once and then you're all set. As a child under five, you might have many, many episodes of diarrhea. That's just an example. But what that causes is a constant state of damage in your gut, and that's the term that Rob mentioned as environmental enteropathy, and that's, again, it's a complex topic and it will take us a long time to talk through, but this is just to outline that what you have in the sort of yellow is essentially the different symptoms of poor gut health, which leads to malabsorption of nutrients. So you could have a really good diet, but you're living in an environment which has poor hygiene and sanitation, or you're exposed to pathogens through human-livestock interactions, you'll end up having nutrient malabsorption, and therefore you'll have a poor growth outcome. And this is something that is not new, it's known, but we're sort of just trying to understand better how these interlink with each other. So I'm going to move on and give you two case studies, and one of them is an aflatoxin study. We call it the AFLA cohort study, which is going on in Nepal, and many of you might be familiar of the prevalence of aflatoxin contamination all across sub-Saharan Africa, and we've got some research on that through other innovation labs as well as ours, but I wanted to focus on Nepal because this is probably one of the few studies on the human nutrition end that is looking at aflatoxins in South Asia. And what you have here is a graph of aflatoxin levels in pregnant women, and this is in the serum of these pregnant women, so it is not in their food supply. We actually took blood samples of these women. There are about 1,700 of them that were enrolled in our study. And the first thing I want to point out is that there is a seasonal effect of aflatoxin. So what you're looking at is a graph, and I'm sorry I've got the Nepali and Hindu calendar months here, but what it reflects is December through April of a year, so you're talking winter to spring, you find the highest level of aflatoxins in these pregnant women. So what does that mean? what we're finding is that the higher the level of aflatoxin, they have certain food practices. And you won't be surprised that maize and groundnuts are the two major commodities that we are finding are very strongly linked to aflatoxin levels in these pregnant women. And what I should point out is that the maize consumption is actually very low. This is sort of the plains, the Gangetic plains in the far west of Nepal. So, but they still have some maize consumption, probably not as much as you would find in sub-Saharan Africa. But no matter what, you're finding a very strong relationship. The groundnut consumption is a little higher. Now, this is just to outline to you, these are actually maize and groundnut groundnuts that we picked up from one of our households. This was in January of 2016. And a lot of them do report seeing green fungus and seeing mold on their grains. They don't necessarily use it for human consumption, but they will give it to their livestock. In fact, that was what the intention of the household was for that maize. And for the groundnuts, the family was going to actually use it to plant for next year. So this is a significant issue from an agricultural perspective. But I'm going to put the nutrition lens back on and take you into what does that mean. So these pregnant women, we've actually followed them up at births, and we've looked at their birth weight prevalence. And birth weight is a really important predictor of stunting. The rate is high, it's about 20%, and it's not unusual in South Asia. You do find high, low birth weight prevalences. What you do see is that the relationship of aflatoxin to low birth weight is essentially women who had higher aflatoxin levels were more likely to have low birth weight babies. And we ran a logistic regression to see how, if we were to adjust, because we're nutritionists, there could be other factors that could affect. It's not just aflatoxin. So we did some multivariate analysis, and what you're seeing at the top, it's a very tight association, but it's there, and increased levels of aflatoxin increases the risk of low birth weight. And this is after we have adjusted for the diet diversity. Diet diversity was protective, which is telling us that when women in pregnancy were consuming good diets, they had better birth weights for their kids, which is what nutritionists love to see. But the problem was that this was offset by the aflatoxin that was in their system. So in this study, what we are planning to do, and in this study is actually just about ongoing. It's one of our PhD students. And she's following up now on trying to understand how this is now related to stunting within the first year of life. So there'll be more data coming out. We're still in the process of collecting the data on their heights at the first year of life. From that note, I'm going to move on to the second case study that I wanted to talk about, and this was sort of the issue of unintended consequences. And this is a study that we have, it's a secondary analysis that we conducted using data from one of our panel studies from northern Uganda, and we've been active in four districts of northern Uganda. And we conducted a multivariate analysis of data that was collected. We had ag data, we had household data on nutrition, we have individual dietary data, and we have data on anemia. And what we found was that cattle ownership was very associated with malaria in these four districts. And what was interesting is malaria was linked to 28% increase in anemia. And most of the times when we talk about anemia, we think it's nutrient-related anemia, but it's a lot of the anemia that you're seeing in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa are linked to infections such as malaria. And that's something that's really, really important to understand because it has different mechanisms and it has different interventions it requires different interventions. Now, what was very interesting, and this is what I want to point out to you all, is that two of these four districts had indoor residual spraying. Now, many of you might be familiar with the spraying for mosquitoes in urban neighborhoods all over South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. In the case of northern Uganda, they were spraying in the rural areas as well. And what was great was the households that were in these districts had lower prevalence of malaria and anemia. They're like, okay, great, that's it. The solution is indoor residual spraying. Well, guess what? Cattle ownership confounded this relationship because if the household had cattle, they still had malaria, and that was linked to the anemia in the households. So the question is, what is really going on? We were very fortunate at the same time that we were in these areas, CDC was collecting mosquito samples for analysis of different species, and I'm not going to go through what the different species were, but what they found, which is very interesting, that has allowed us to publish a fascinating paper, is that the outdoor mosquito species were more prominent in the IRS district. So while the public health angle, we thought, oh, we took care of the mosquito problem, therefore the malaria is going to be lower. But because of cattle ownership, you had outdoor mosquito species that were not targeted by the IRS. So this is just a story of unintended consequences that I wanted to share with you. And I think one of the key things is for us to better understand how it is not to say you shouldn't have cattle ownership in these districts because it's going to be linked to malaria and anemia. The question is, if you are going to encourage human-livestock interactions, what are the different issues that you need to consider within the context of human nutrition and health? So I just want to end this presentation by giving, I just thought I would spend a little bit of time looking at all the different innovation labs. We're about 30 innovation labs. I might be wrong with the number at this point. But there is a lot of data and a lot of research that has been going on in the past 7 years, which has been my interaction with the innovation labs. And I know there's a lot more history there. But there's been very new and innovative areas within the, from a public health lens of linking nutrition to agriculture, one being the gut microbiome, looking at areas of intestinal health. We know that there is a study going on in the legume lab trying to understand how legumes could improve intestinal health and therefore reduce the risk of things like severe malnutrition. I've talked a little bit about the food safety work that the innovation lab is doing in Tufts, but there are other innovation labs that are looking at aflatoxins, mycotoxins, the whole area of dietary diversity in production and marketing of nutrient-dense foods. We tend to sort of we don't really pay attention as much on the issue of markets, and I can talk at length about the things that we are finding on markets. And of course, you have the post-harvest losses handling and storage activities that are at least two innovation labs are actively involved in. So thank you very much for listening to me, and I'm sure we'll have some questions once Jerry comes back here. Thanks so much.